Hello and welcome back to Fourth Estate, a show about journalism. We're coming to you from 2SER in Sydney on the Gadigal lands of the Eora Nation, right across Australia on the Community Radio Network, and directly to your device across the globe via podcast. I'm Tina Quinn, and as always, it's a pleasure to have your company. Well, we all know what's upon us this weekend. We're nearing, or some might say crawling to, the finish line of the Australian federal election campaign. So in this edition of Fourth Estate, we ask, do leaders' debates help the undecided voter? Or are we simply witnessing the argy-bargy replica of Question Time? Has the Fourth Estate highlighted the issues that are important to voters? And what happens when politicians don't show up? To discuss this and more, we're joined by an esteemed panel. Phil Khoury is the political editor at the Australian Financial Review. He's been covering federal politics since he joined The Advertiser in 1998. He then later on went to work for the Sydney Morning Herald as their chief political correspondent in 2006, before defecting to The Fin in 2012, where he spent the last decade. Phil Khoury, a warm welcome to Fourth Estate.
Thank you very much.
Paul Karp has been a political reporter for Guardian Australia since 2016. He was previously a journalist at Thomson Reuters covering industrial relations for the Workforce News Service. Paul, welcome to Fourth Estate.
Cheers, thanks for having us.
And Rachel Withers is also with us. Her sharp analysis can be found in The Monthly, where she serves as contributing editor, and she's also the host of the Politics podcast. She's previously freelanced for Slate, Vox and Crikey. Rachel, a warm welcome to Fourth Estate.
Thank you for having me.
Now, in this fast-paced election coverage, I should note that we are recording this on Wednesday night, the 18th of May. So let's hop right to it. Let's talk about debates. We had three leaders' debates, one on Sky News, one on the Nine Network, and one on Channel 7. Do you think leaders' debates can sway voters in any way? Rachel, I'm going to go to you first.
Yeah, look, I think it can certainly sway some people. I think we saw with a couple of the undecided voters who were there as a litmus test for that, some of them had clearly already made up their mind, I think, based on what they had to say afterwards. But I do think when it's done right, it can be a really good way for voters to actually hear from the leaders themselves, not through a press conference or through a written interview, but to actually have them put their policies forward themselves. And I especially thought that the first debate, the Sky News one, was surprisingly the very best one because the voters got to ask the questions themselves.
As opposed to the journos. Okay. That's an interesting point. Phil, as you've previously said, this is your 600th election that you've covered. So what do you think? Do you think leaders' debates, in your experience, can they sway voters?
Oh, most definitely, yes. I mean, for a lot of people who don't sort of tune into politics like we do, it's often the first serious look they take at both of them, and there's always an element of curiosity over a head-to-head contest. And, you know, in recent elections, we've seen the evolution, as Rachel was saying, of the People's Forum, which I think it's good to have a mix. The People's Forums are always good because it's harder to lie or dissemble or sidestep questions from a punter than it is a journalist, and they're often sort of fairly earthy questions as well. So they're good, but I also think it's important to have sort of, you know, the other format as well, where you can get some sort of serious policy questions asked as well, sort of test them a bit. So it's good to have a mixture of both. And I thought we sort of had three pretty different debates this campaign, and I think they all made a contribution to helping form opinions.
These debates they've become a regular fixture in the election campaigns, in election campaigns in general. But Paul, do you think they're still relevant?
Well, I think it's a shame more people don't watch them, and it shouldn't make it hard for people by waiting until after Lego Masters and Big Brother in order to get that information. But I do think they are still relevant, particularly because they influence the coverage, at least for one news cycle. You know, Anthony Albanese was, the first week was the gaffes, unable to remember unemployment and the cash rate. But winning the first debate, the Sky News debate, did help him sort of break that and, you know, say, yes, he is across the detail enough to stand up in an hour-long debate format. So it does influence the coverage.
What did you think of the fact that we had, three debates,
somewhat late at night on commercial broadcasters, none of which on the public broadcaster. Phil, have you ever seen, in your experience, have you sort of seen the public broadcaster shunned in such a way before during an election campaign?
Not so much. I think as a broadcaster, you're going to put your hand in and demand a debate. I think you should at least put it on at a reasonable hour. I mean, the last one on Channel 7 was, I was trying to stay awake for that one.
Did the game show music not help a little bit? The sort of build up to the, no? Okay.
No.
Didn't make it more exciting?
The thing that really annoys me, and it happens every single election campaign, it's because the major parties can never agree on whether they have this debates commission. I would just really like to have, one debate, at some venue like the National Press Club, the ABC, and let everyone take the feed. Anyone who wants to, Sky News, the 7, 9, 10, and the ABC all take the feed. And people who want to watch it can watch it. And you do it at a reasonable hour, like 7:30 on a Sunday night. I think the voters are owed at least that. But it just seems every election campaign there's this unedifying squabble. The major parties can't agree. They fight over who the hosts are going to be. And it's always been thus. This is the first time I think the ABC didn't get one last time, but I think they got to televise it from the National Press Club. So it is the first time, but I don't really see a problem as long as it's on some free-to-air channel. It doesn't have to be the ABC, but it should be on at a civil hour. At least the Sky debate was on at a reasonable hour, but so few people have Sky News. Unless you live in the regions where you can watch it free-to-air, you have to have a subscription. But look, it's really beyond our hands. It's really in the hands of the major parties, but they can never seem to agree.
Having one at least on a free-to-air channel, I'd say even like less and less young people even have access to free-to-air TV set up in their homes. I know a lot of my friends would have liked to watch it, and when it came to trying to watch something on even 9 or 7, they were scrambling to work out, an online login or where they could stream it. There's potentially a discussion to be had about having more sort of online young person friendly debate formats as well.
I managed to live stream it, Rachel, and I'm 1,000 years old.
We all got there in the end. We did get there in the end.
Download the app and everything, but it worked.
Yeah. Do you think a particular channel came out on top for hosting the best quality debate? I mean, the Nine debate was criticised because of all the shouting. Rachel, were any of them outstanding in your opinion? Or
I think in the end, the Seven stood out for the quality of the questions and the policy discussion. And I don't know if that's because they were able to learn from Nine's. What was it that Catherine Murphy called it?
Shitstorm.
A shitstorm, yeah. And so I don't know if opening that with, asking that they not interrupt each other was a direct result of Nine's shitstorm. But, yeah, I certainly thought Seven's was the one that voters would have been most informed by. Whether or not they were still coming back after watching Nine's, it's not clear, but certainly that one to me, I was able to even glean things about policies that, I just got nothing from Nine's.
Politicians and candidates are usually quite picky with which media they decide to front up to. I mean, we've seen, politicians politely declining or ignoring and point blank refusing to be interviewed by certain media. So, the first one, of course, that comes to mind would be the Prime Minister, Scott Morrison. He didn't make a final major address to the National Press Club. And look, as to quote Laura Tingle today, he's the first PM in over 50 years to not give this address. What do you think this says about the government's relationship with the media? I'm going to go to you, Paul.
Well, I think Scott Morrison has a very definite view about who he needs to talk to in the final week of the campaign. And so I think he's just commercial TV and radio are his main, channels to get through to undecided voters and who are, low information voters, low engagement voters who don't like politics, who decide at the last minute. I think it's disappointing for reasons of, lack of transparency that he won't submit himself to all of those, including the ABC. But from a tactical point of view about who he wants to reach, it makes sense that he does that, even if we, rightly grumble about it.
Phil, do you think, I mean, obviously you spent many years covering the prime ministership of John Howard. Now, I don't think he was the greatest fan of the ABC's coverage of him, but he never failed to front up to them.
No, but look, just back to the press club, Morrison is completely entitled to do what he did today. Bill Shorten didn't turn up last time. And Laura didn't mention that today. It was actually Bill Shorten who broke the convention in 2019. He vetoed the press club and went and did a campaign-style rally in Western Sydney on the Thursday before the election and made a point of it. And Scott Morrison said to me a couple of weeks ago, well, Bill's broken the convention, so I no longer feel bound by it. And it was much more – look, this bloke's got, you know, 2 weeks to live politically. He has to do what he thinks. They don't owe us anything. I think this sort of preciousness amongst journos as if we're somehow equal or superior to our subject matter, it's not. They don't owe us anything. They're not there to keep us happy. They're there to win elections. If Morrison thought speaking to the press club today or the ABC or whatever was going to help him, he'd do it. But he figured his time was better served being in a couple of marginal seats and speaking to a business audience in Melbourne. Now, that may be the wrong decision. It was certainly the wrong decision by Bill Shorten back in 2019. But, you know, it was Bill who sort of set the modern precedent not to turn up. And you know, Morrison did what he has to do. I mean, imagine if he loses the election and he stands up on Saturday night and said, we just lost, but at least I spoke to the press club. You know, it's not his, you know, it's not his priority. He's not here to make journalists happy. He's here to win an election for the Liberal Party, and the same for Albanese. And Albanese, obviously it was in his interest to speak to the press club today. You know, I just think we've got to stop being so precious about ourselves. I really do. I would have much rather the PM turned up and did the press club, clearly, but I'm not going to sort of get on my high horse and get all frothy about it. I mean,
it's not that we're owed it.
We've got to cope with it. Yeah.
It's not that we're owed it, though, Phil. It's just that it would be better for transparency if he answered difficult questions about his, you know, first home buyer super withdrawal scheme instead of the enormously soft run that he got on Kyle and Jackie O.
But he stands up every day at doorstops and gets asked questions. I mean, it's not like, you know, he took a bunch of questions this morning from you guys in Corangamite. You could ask him 10 questions on it there. I know, but I wouldn't have asked him about that today. I would have asked him about something else. But the point being, it's not like they're not making themselves available each day. Both of them are, you know, subjecting themselves to pretty lengthy press conferences every day.
Rachel, do you agree with that assessment? I mean, you know, some might argue that, no, he doesn't have an obligation to journalists, or he doesn't owe anything to journalists as such, but he has an obligation to the taxpaying voter who would hopefully gain something from an address at the National Press Club.
I would agree that he doesn't owe journalists that, but I think it's in democracy's interests that we do have these forums where the candidates can be questioned in a probably calmer, more detailed sort of way than what we're seeing at the press conferences, where it is just so much shouting and who can get the question in next, or, you know, who the candidate chooses to call on in the press conference. And then, you know, those have become more and more difficult to watch. And, you know, this is the first election that I've been following the day-to-day, you know, minutiae of the campaign, and just very little information comes out of that. I can see that just for the soundbite in the end, that each side is hoping to land their soundbite, or each journalist is hoping to land their soundbite. And, you know, I think it would just be so much healthier for democracy to have the Prime Minister front up to a forum where he can be asked questions by journalists, where all the journalists, well, every outlet gets a shot. I don't quite know how exactly the press club lineup works, but in a way where it's not who can get their question out the loudest or the fastest, or, you know, whoever the candidate has chosen to hear. And I think, yeah, so while he is, you know, fronting up to press conferences every day, I think it's just better that we have these forums that really help people get information. I think that's what seems to be missing from the entire campaign, is like a focus on what is the best way to get information and the most accurate information, and transmit that to voters so that they can use it.
Do you think the media can properly do their job when they're faced with an empty seat? We saw on Tuesday night this week, NITV had their point election special, and they had a representative from the Labour Party, they had a representative from the Greens as well. But not only was obviously Prime Minister Scott Morrison not available to NITV, but no representative from the Liberal Party was provided. Paul?
Well, obviously, the empty chair is an attempt to shame the recalcitrant party to send someone to tell them that, you know, we're not going to cancel this event just because you're not coming. But, you know, if you have to do the empty chair trick, then the threat hasn't worked. I guess it is disappointing the coalition didn't send someone for the NITV special. You know, maybe not enough people are across the Indigenous Affairs brief, but that, you know, that in itself is disappointing.
You're listening to Fourth Estate on the Community Radio Network, and my guests this week are The Monthly's Rachel Withers, Guardian Australia's Paul Karp, and The Australian Financial Review's Phil Khoury. As we're coming to the end of this election campaign, in what ways do you think the media has actually effectively cut through the political spin? Rachel, to you first.
I have enjoyed sort of some of the media criticism going on in this campaign, Margaret Simon's campaign, for example. And I think it is really helpful sometimes to take a step back and look at what is being focused on or what is being covered and how. Unfortunately, I think that there are a lot of journalists in the campaign who are, you know, not particularly interested in cutting through the games and the spin. They're interested in playing the games and the spin. And I think it would be really useful if we could have more of a conversation, I think, about what we're trying to do here, basically. But I think, you know, there's been a lot of defensiveness from some corners of the media when it comes to that. I think I've been seeing some interesting things with social media. The Daily Oz, for example, has been sort of trying to do different things and target different audiences through totally different mediums in a way I think that is really new to this campaign. Speaking to young people, for example, who are so often not spoken to in campaigns. And I don't think the candidates are doing a great job of that themselves, but I think that that is a place where the media has picked up the ball and is cutting through and trying to speak to young people about their issues.
Phil, what do you think? What are you sort of seeing the media effectively cut through on?
It's hard to sort of speak for everybody. But I know at the Financial Review, you know, right from the outset, we adopted a sort of fairly heavy policy focus. So just, you know, and our editor's quite a wonk on policy. So, you know, right at the start when both leaders were sort of making glib assertions and claims, you know, on industrial relations and the economy and stuff like that, we would actually sort of test them out a bit, you know. You know, Anthony Albanese might say something, you know, three out of every four workers have to have three jobs to survive. And we'd actually go and get the data on that and actually test whether it was true or not. We've done quite a lot of that during the campaign because campaigns, yeah, by their very nature, tend to be very superficial. Things get said and then not sufficiently tested out. And then the next day, the whole caravan moves on to another topic. I don't know. I've lost count of how many times I've said, you know, the key battleground of this election is X. You know, the key battlegrounds were changing every day and a half. So we've made a conscious effort at the AFR to, you know, to sort of just, you know, walk through a lot of this stuff and test a lot of this stuff and challenge it. So that I can only really speak for us. Others, I think others, print media predominantly, you know, online print media have sort of done more of that where the TV coverage has, you know, been a bit more superficial. But it's just the nature of campaigns. There hasn't been, you know, a lot of policy detail in this campaign. It's been so personal. You know, it's really been about both candidates sort of engaging in character assassination and so forth. But, you know, we had some good stuff. When Anthony Albanese, you know, on the fly, you know, advocated a 5.1% wage increase, I mean, it took him 3 days. He spun his way out of it after about 3 days. But there were some, you know, propositions that arose with that proposal that needed to be tested, and it was clear he was sort of making up as he went along, and he got his way out of it in the end. But you know, you don't let these people off lightly. That they sort of they make a big statement. So you know, it's like everything in every campaign. Some people skate over it. Others, you know, our sort of audience is our readers are sort of, you know, into policy and detail and stuff like that. So you just cater for your audience. You know, at the other end of the spectrum, others just go for the gotcha question and you know, try and make them look stupid, which we didn't really get involved in.
Right. Okay. Well, I mean, some might argue that your economics correspondent, Mr. Meisen, didn't really follow that brief.
and he learned his lesson very quickly. And I said to Ron, if you weren't on Twitter, you wouldn't ask that question. I said, who were you trying to impress with that question? You only ask those sorts of questions if you're on Twitter. That's why I dumped Twitter 18 months ago. Don't look at it. Can't be bothered with it because it gets into your head and makes you do silly things like that. So
right.
That was our one example.
I honestly thought he was trying to be funny with that question, like because it had been so in the media over the previous 48 hours, I think, the gotcha topic. And I thought it was a little funny joke at the end of a serious question.
He was trying to smart ass him on. I didn't know what he was saying. I said, I didn't know what the WPI was either. But yeah, no, Ron came back with his tail between his legs and he learned his lesson. You know, and the reporters we've had on the road, we've had people on the road for the entirety of the campaign and they've been under strict instructions. You just behave yourself and be professional and don't become unedifying and go for the smart-ass question. Just try and get something out of them.
It was interesting today that Morrison was asked about COVID and looked at his notes and rattled off the numbers, you know, deaths in aged care, total deaths since the start of the pandemic in the last 24 hours. And it's clear that he'd prepared for a gotcha question, but the question wasn't really a gotcha. It was just like, you know, what are you going to do to try and get the death toll down? And he was trying to impress us all by rattling the statistics off when it wasn't the point.
Paul, I was actually going to say, talking about the moment for you where the media was really able to cut through the political spin, you literally popped your head through a window today so you could get your question through, hoping to cut through some spin, no doubt. Tell us about that moment and how that came about, because it's, you know, obviously it's gone off on Twitter and has become sort of the moment of the day.
I think the moment of the day was Scott Morrison decking a small child.
That's not to be forgotten either, no.
But before that, there was the window question. So
yes.
He'd taken a bunch of questions from his right-hand side. Most of them were about wages. Journalists, once they'd had their question, had moved back. So I'd got to the front of where he was taking questions from, but he was determined not to take it. So I thought, well, I can stand here and shout my head off, or I could try something different. I noticed that a few photographers had taken photos of him through that window, and I thought, well, okay, well, why don't I just bob up on his left side this time, trying the same question where he's not going to expect me. And people were sort of pointing and giggling at me attempting this for one or two questions, but before he took it, and it worked. I'm not sure if he knew I was there until it was too late.
So there's a lot of criticism, as I guess there usually is, directed at News Corp for the type of tabloid coverage they've been serving up during this campaign. Does anybody on the panel think we're seeing anything new here? Paul, to you?
Well, this is my third election. They went pretty hard on Bill at the last two elections, so I'm not sure it is anything new. It really depends whether Labor can develop a frame for the election that breaks through what the conservative tabloids try to tear them down with. So in the 2016 election, the tabloids were smashing them for, you know, all the Labor left candidates that had opposed boat turnbacks. But then Labor produced this campaign that was, you know, an even bigger scare against the coalition about Mediscare, and then no one was really thinking about these tabloid front pages that had been running for weeks and weeks in the campaign when they were voting. Last election, you know, I think the coalition's fear campaign on tax on Labor was the successful frame that people were thinking of as they voted, and so the tabloid coverage was probably more influential then. This time, you know, it remains to be seen. Albanese certainly seems to have had a pretty rough run.
One thing I would add there is that the Australian in particular seems so much more focused on the teal independents than Labor at the moment. I mean, they're certainly having a go at Labor as well, but there's this other enemy that they're focused on demonising, and it's just, you know, column after column dedicated to the idea of the hung parliament, you know, the gridlock, the chaos, or the fact that these independents aren't
these
real
fake independents.
Yes.
Fake independents, yes.
And yeah, and so I think they just, if there's one thing that the Australian seems obsessed with in this election, it's not Anthony Albanese's socialist roots or, you know, whatever else we might have been expecting, because there's this third presence that they seem to have it in for far more than they do for Labor.
That's the battle inside the Conservatives. But look, as to the tabloids, I mean, when I first came to Canberra, you know, in late 90s, you know, they were just so powerful, the News Corp tabloids, and all through, you know, for the 10 to 15 years after I first got here. I mean, they set the agenda. The Daily Telegraph, whatever was on the front page that day, was what the commercial news has run on their 6 o'clock news that night. But I'm sort of with Paul, but I think they lost their influence in terms of the ability to really affect elections. First in 2013, if you remember, when Anastasia Palaszczuk pulled off the biggest swing in electoral history and reversed and knocked off Campbell Newman after one term with this massive swing. And I remember watching that election every single day, the Courier Mail, every single day for 40 days, punched her up on the front page, and she won with that swing. And I remember thinking then, and this is sort of as social media was starting to emerge, you know, they're not as powerful as they used to be. And then later that year in the federal election, they just went after the federal Labor, you know, and Kevin Rudd just knocked off Gillard. And federal Labor held nearly, I think, every single seat in Western Sydney, which is the tellies market, except for banks. And I think 2013 was the year the Murdoch tabloids lost their, you know, lost their almighty power, and it's only got less ever since. And I think what we've seen in this campaign is they've become more shrill. They're just going nuts. They're going absolutely nuts at the moment. You know, they're not even pretending. You know, in some instances, I counted an opening couple of paragraphs the other day on the Teal Independence. I think there was about six pejorative adjectives in the first two pars. And if anything, I think they actually help this, you know, the teals and whatever, because they just highlight them. And so to me, it's a, you know, I think that they've just diminished greatly in influence. You know, Rachel, you, Paul know a lot better than me that, you know, people get their news from a lot more broader sources now, and you know, social media and so forth, and they're just competing in a much larger space and sort of yelling louder but not really being noticed. You know, Labor would prefer it wasn't happening, but they're nowhere near sort of worried about it. They used to fret about the tabloids and keep them awake at night and go and plead with editors for a fair go. They don't even bother now. That washes over them.
Well, Albanese has still done a couple of interviews, I think, that have quite upset the more left-leaning Labor voters or people further to the left of Labor who have been, you know, I think that there is still that obligation to go kiss the ring or whatever you want to call it. And Albanese's fronted up to the Daily Telegraph with the whole "I'm not woke" answered sort of gotcha questions in a different form, but he's answered the sort of quick fire, like, "prove I'm not woke" questions. So like that is still going on, I think.
Look, I know we've already touched on gaffes, but Rachel, you highlighted in the Politics podcast earlier this month the media's obsession with tripping up candidates with gotchas and gaffes to test if, you know, they're, quote, up to it, I guess. Now, we've seen a decrease in this practice since the start of the election campaign, but it's still prevalent. You know, do you think the media has really listened and responded fairly to the criticism? I mean, you know, only the other week we saw Jonathan Kersley from Nine at this media conference with Albanese. You know, Albo was there talking to climate policy, and Jonathan Kersley decided to circle back to the NDIS. It seemed quite clear that he was trying to trip him up and ask him to list the 6 points from the Labor Party's NDIS policy document. Albo clearly tried to hold him off until an advisor of some sort handed him a policy document, and then, you know, it ended in Jonathan Kersley basically screaming that he, you know, at Albo that he didn't know what he was talking about. He didn't know the 6 points to one of his portfolios. He has about 25 that he looks after. You know, again, we seem to have the media performing a pop quiz on these leaders and trying to get them to recite what are basically motherhood statements. I mean, they're not the 6 points of his NDIS plan are very top line things. They're not really going deep on policy or what his overall vision would be for that portfolio.
What was seemed ridiculous about those points is, you know, if you looked at the Labor website, there were 12 dot points, and on another page there were 10. And then I think David Crowe mentioned in a piece he wrote about it that when they exclusively reported on the policy, there were no dot points at all. So, you know, there was this obsession with a very particular 6 dot points that weren't necessarily going to tell you anything about the policy, but these were the 6 points that Jonathan Kearsley wanted. But yeah, I mean, I think Paul's right that it does depend, your take on this question sort of depends on whether you thought it mattered. But I thought what was more interesting was the conversation that took place over the next 24 hours, which was, I saw a lot of the media defending this kind of gotcha or not question, but with the, you know, bringing up the idea that the media needed to check if Albanese was quite up to it. And I thought, you know, to me that really articulated this sentiment that seemed to be going on, that the media seemed to think that it's their job to test the opposition leader to see if they can do the job, when really what does being able to recite dot points or being able to handle a hostile press conference have to do with being the Prime Minister? I mean, you could argue, yes, the Prime Minister is going to have to do press conferences, but why do we have this idea of a hostile media that needs to be handled or stood up to or treated like Xi Jinping, according to one questioner? You know, how does that really give voters any information about what kind of candidate this is and what kind of Prime Minister they're going to be?
I think there's some frustration at Albanese from the press gallery because, you know, for years he's run such a small target. You ask him what he thinks about anything, he says, oh, well, it's for the government to solve that. I think it was an almost sort of vindictive streak in the questioning. In that they were like so sick of you know, him not holding press conferences or not answering questions that they're like, right, we're going to get you with, you know, absolute curly ones. That
he had a pretty free run for a number of years. He rarely did press conferences in Canberra, and it's probably the first chance a lot of people have had to go to
get him back.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, but obviously then if there's been all these years of not being able to ask questions, there should be a lot of real questions to ask him. And there's the complaint about the small target election campaign as well, but there certainly are policies to ask about. I mean, he was asking about a policy that is a real policy, but instead of asking about the policy, he wanted to know what the 6 points were.
The rule to that, Rachel, is don't have a point plan. They're really lazy. You're going to have one, never have more than 3 points. Anything more than a 3-point plan is rubbish. The point you're making, and it's a good point, and one of the problems that this election campaign has really exposed is the fact that press conferences are now televised. Right, they never used to be televised. They've been televised now for the last 5 or 6 years. A press conference is just part of a process. It's not the entirety of what happens. Right. Mm-hmm. So you know, Paul and I, as sort of print, you know, online journalists, we don't go to press conferences to show off. We go to actually find something out, right? So I may ask a question at a press conference, which is, I'm writing about something and I need more information, or I need a quote, or they may have announced something and I want more detail on what they've announced. My end product is not the press conference. My end product is what appears online and in the paper the next day. Same with Paul, I imagine. But for a lot of TV reporters, it's just become theatre. Yeah, look at me be an asshole on TV to the opposition leader or the Prime Minister. And on the very first day when Albo got wrong-footed on the unemployment number and the interest rate, and the journalist who asked that question was sort of lionized as, you know, look what a great job she did. And you could almost hear the executive producers of all the other TV journalists going, we want you doing that too. And it became this sort of screaming over each other to, you know, to put the hard question, as they call it, to the side. It's not a hard question. It's just an accusation. You know, you're an idiot. Admit it, sort of stuff. That doesn't elicit any information or help with discourse, civil or otherwise. It's just and then they'll have a cutaway of them on the news asking the question. And I think that's what's really become prevalent in this campaign, especially amongst the TV reporters. And I know my colleagues on the trail have become quite frustrated because you can't get a question in. You know, I'll ring, you know, one of my colleagues and say, look, we need to peg Morrison or Albanese on X, Y, or Z for a story we're doing on industrial relations or tax reform or something. And it's just really hard actually to get a meaningful, you know, policy-based question in. And I think the media as a whole has come off quite poorly. I think it looks bad on TV. I know both Morrison and Albanese have been quite sort of perplexed and angered by the feral nature of the press pack. It's been much worse this campaign than any before it. And I blame it on just, you know, it's become live televised sport rather than a genuine exercise in seeking information.
Tell them to do the window trick, Phil.
Oh, mate, that's the best one yet.
So turning now to the actual issues at hand, which politicians should be prosecuting, a survey by the Australian National University revealed that the top issues for voters are fixing aged care, the cost of living, the cost of healthcare, and climate change. Now, we've definitely seen cost of living covered by the media, but what voter issues do you think haven't really been covered? Paul, I mean, for instance, you asked the Prime Minister today about what he's doing to curtail COVID-19 infections and deaths within Australia. Now, the rest of the media don't seem all that interested in covering COVID, but do you think it's actually a prevalent issue for voters, or are they just as happy to forget about that one?
No, that ANU thing had found that it had dropped down well and truly in voters' minds as well, that, you know, only 30% of people said it was a top priority for the incoming government, which is pretty low given, you know, 2 years of the pandemic being the number one issue. I would also say that I think that, you know, climate hasn't got enough attention because, you know, Labor's policy is more ambitious emissions reduction than the coalition. The coalition does have a split, you know, this time in, you know, Matt Canavan and that bloke Boyce saying that net zero is flexible or it's dead, you know, whereas they've got the opposite message in the inner city. So, you know, I think that there needs to be more focus on climate, especially given how central it's going to be in any negotiations if there were a hung parliament.
Rachel?
Yeah, look, I would say that one big one for a large part of the campaign was the women's issues that I think so many people expected or hoped would be a large part of this campaign. It really hasn't been. Obviously, that issue dropped off the radar slowly over the past 12 months. Even from day one, with sort of Alan Tudge's status as a minister being in question, it seemed like it was going to be a big part of the campaign, but it's just the reckoning we had hasn't really featured a lot in this election. That's not actually on ANU's list of topics, so I don't know where it fits in there, but I do know certainly that it hasn't featured in the way that I think a lot of advocacy groups and just women expected it would. And we've seen there are like some great Women for Progress did a scorecard that came out the other day and that got a little bit of coverage. But ultimately it's not really something, it's obviously not something that the coalition has wanted to talk about. But it's also not really something that the Labor Party has chosen to particularly highlight either.
So no doubt all eyes will be on the polls in the next few days. Do any of you have faith in the news polls this year? I mean, they've let many of us down over the last number of years. The latest Reserve poll today, of course, has got a lot of people talking, which predicts that Labor's lead against the coalition is definitely narrowing. But that's from the Reserve poll. Now, there are questions around the methodologies that they use. Reserve don't allow public scrutiny of their numbers or their methodologies, and they're also not a member of the industry body, the Australian Polling Council.
Yeah. I'm just choosing to really not think about it too much. There's been so many things written about polling, you know, methodology and how it's been fixed, but I think they're just so hard to really place any stock in now, even when you can see the whole methodology written out.
No, look, I disagree, Rach. The problem with the last election wasn't the polls. It was the way they were written. There's a very strict discipline when you write polls. And, when I first started writing them for the Sydney Morning Herald, the Nielsen poll, there was only two polls. There was ours and the News poll and the Australian. And there was these sort of certain rules. You never predicted from a poll. Poll was always a snapshot. So, this is what might happen if the election was held today. It could be no more definite than that. You mentioned margins of error. You didn't make too much of a 1 or a 2 point shift because it was margin of error. They're nothing more than a rough guide of a moment in time. And what's happened is they've become very cheap and easy to do, and a lot of them aren't very good. And basic rules about sample size have been ignored. I mean, you should really never trust a poll with a sample size less than 1,000, whether it's in a marginal seat or nationwide. And I remember in the last election especially, they were a dime a dozen, these things, robo-polls, 300 people in a seat, and they weren't assisted. Assisted polling, if you do a poll in an electorate, you really need to mention the names of the candidate. You say, Fred Nerk for the Labor Party and, Mary Bloggs for the Liberal Party. If you just say Labor and Liberal, you get a Morrison Albanese type answer. The methodology has to be really good. The reporting has to be judicious. What we saw today is three separate polls. Now, they're all different numbers, but what is consistent is that they've all closed. So Resolve is only relative to Resolve because Resolve has its own methodology. So you can't compare Resolve to News poll, but if Resolve tightens from the previous Resolve and the Morgan poll tightened from the previous Morgan poll and the Essential poll and the Guardian tightened from the previous Essential poll, which is what happened today, all three of them did that. Now, they had a two-party ranging from 51 to 54, I think it was, or 53. That's only a two-point spread, but you can take it to the bank. There's been a tightening, but you can't take it to a bank which number is actually right. So it's accurate to report Morrison is coming back, but you can't say any more than that. And I think this is where people get themselves into trouble saying, Morrison's going to win or Labor's still going to win. And, it's just some very irresponsible reporting of polls in the last election has really given them a bad name.
Yeah.
So the other thing too is, the national number becomes less relevant the closer you get to election.
Mm-hmm.
Because, the major parties don't poll everything. I think the Libs are doing 20 seats and the Labor's doing 27 seats, what's called the track. They track the 20 or 27 most marginal seats only. They don't worry about the rest of the electorates, right, because the election's won or lost in the margins.
Well, to end on, I'm going to ask all three of you a question that I'm sure none of you really want to have to answer or put your names to an answer. Predictions. What do we think is going to happen this weekend? Rachel, who do you think Australians are going to be waking up to as their Prime Minister on Sunday morning?
Look, it's hard not to respond too dramatically to that poll that came out, those several polls that came out this morning that really saw things tighten. I think prior to that, I would have said it was probably going to be a Labor majority. It was looking like there were so many seats. They were into the chance of picking up and just very few for the coalition to get back. But yeah, after that latest poll, and we don't put too much stock in polls, but I'm thinking it's more likely going to be a hung parliament. It'd probably be Labor in the driver's seat, but I think we're back in hung parliament territory.
Paul?
I've been saying for most of the campaign, I feel like the 2020 presidential election, where Biden was further ahead of Trump than Hillary was, and so it would take a polling error even larger than 2016 for Trump to win. The polls started further apart than they were last time in 2019, so it looks like a larger polling error would have to have taken place for Morrison to, come up with the second miracle. In the same way, Trump would have needed an even larger polling error in 2020 to beat Biden. But I recognise that polls have narrowed. I still think a slim Labor majority.
And Phil?
Yeah, I agree with the others. I think, hung parliament with Labor in the driver's seat or a slim Labor majority. But just something has been eaten away at me for months and months and months, and that Labor just has not done the work to put this election away. So I still think there's probably a twist or turn left that, you know, may surprise us. But if I have to make the decision now on Wednesday night, I'd call it, Labor by a nose.
Well, on that note, I'd like to thank my guests this week on Fourth Estate, Rachel Withers.
No worries.
Paul Karp.
Cheers. Thanks for having us.
And Phil Khoury.
Pleasure.
And thank you for listening to Fourth Estate. This edition was recorded at the studios of 2SER and heard across the country on the Community Radio Network. Fourth Estate is produced with the assistance of the Community Broadcasting Foundation. Thanks to the Foundation for their continuing support. Make sure you subscribe to Fourth Estate on your favourite podcast app so you can hear us talk about media, politics, and a lot in between. We'll be back with more next week, of course, but in the meantime, you can stay in touch with us on Twitter. Our handle is FourthEstateAU. A big thanks, as always, to my producer, Marlene Even, and executive producer, Anthony Dockrell. I'm Tina Quinn. Please do stay well, stay safe, and catch us next time on Fourth Estate.